Blog Talk Radio.
We make a bed.
There's a little song that we sing in our movement down in the South. I don't know if you've heard it, but it has become the theme song. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. Though I join hands so often with students and others behind jail bars singing it, we shall overcome. Sometimes we've had tears in our eyes when we joined together to sing it, but we still decided to sing it. We shall overcome. No, before this victory is won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome. Don't worry about us. Before the victory is won, some of us will lose jobs, but we shall overcome. Before the victory is won, even some will have to face physical death. But if physical death is the price that some must pay to free their children from a permanent psychological death, then nothing shall be more redemptive. We shall overcome. Before the victory is won, some will be misunderstood and called bad names and dismissed as rabble-rousers and agitators. But we shall overcome. And I'll tell you why. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed to earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch above his own. We shall overcome because the Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. And with this faith, we will go out and adjourn the councils of despair and bring new light into the dark chambers of pessimism. And we will be able to rise from the fatigue of despair to the buoyancy of hope. And this will be a great America. We will be the participants in making.
We must also realize that the problems of racial injustice and economic injustice cannot be solved without a radical redistribution of political and economic power.
We read one day, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But if a man doesn't have a job or an income, he has neither life nor liberty and the possibility for the pursuit of happiness. He merely exists.
Estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill in Vietnam, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor.
The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home.
The other thing I want you to understand is this, that it didn't cost the nation one penny to integrate lunch counts. It didn't cost the nation one penny to guarantee the right to vote. But now we are dealing with issues that cannot be solved without the nation spending billions of dollars and undergoing a radical redistribution of economic power.
Yes, yes.
All labor has dignity.
Yes.
But you are doing another thing. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
America's opportunity to help bridge the gulf between the haves and the have-nots. And the question is whether America will do it. There's nothing new about poverty. What is new is that we now have the techniques and the resources to get rid of poverty. And the real question is whether we have the will.
At the very same time that America refused to give the Negro any land, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did they give the land, they built land-grant colleges with government money to teach them how to farm. Not only that, they provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. Not only that, they provided low interest rates in order that they could mechanize their farms. Not only that, today many of these people are receiving millions of dollars in federal subsidies not to farm, and they are the very people telling the black man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. Now, this is what we are faced with, and this is the reality. Now, when we come to Washington in this campaign, we are coming to get our check. I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. And as I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with a pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
What is the relationship between this and the reality of the Negro masses?
Well, to move on out of it for a moment. Martin's very rare, very great man. Martin's rare for two reasons. Part because just because he is. And because he's a real Christian, and he really believes in nonviolence. He's arrived at something in himself, which permits him, allows him to do it. And he still has great moral authority in the South. There's none whatever in the North. Poor Barton has gone through God knows what kind of hell to awaken the American conscience. But Barton has reached the end of his rope. There's something that Martin can't do. Martin's only one man. Martin can't solve the nation's central problem by himself. There are lots of people, lots of black people, I mean now, who don't go to church no more and don't listen to Martin, you know. And anyway, are themselves produced by civilization, which is always glorified violence, unless the Negro has a gun. So that Martin is undercut by the performance of the country. The country is only concerned about nonviolence if it seems
and that there can be no freedom without owning land. Dr. King, as you saw, said that we're owed money and we're coming to get our check. Both Martin and Malcolm demanded not only an end to the physical violence black people have been subjected to, but also an end to the economic violence that has been inflicted on us nonstop. They both understood and expressed the rock-bottom truth that this country hates us because we are black, but it is only able to abuse and oppress us because we are poor. And this nation's top priority is to guarantee and ensure that black people remain in the exact same resource-poor, deprived state in which we were brought to this country. And in one of the most sickening demonstrations of what Dr. John Henry Clark called the evil genius of Europe, you have had the white media who has manufactured a phony version of Dr. King, one that they could try to use to mislead us and get us to sign on to and to, in our own minds, embrace and deify all sorts of concepts that Dr. King didn't stand for, concepts that were meant to help make sure that white supremacy wasn't threatened. When Dr. King was alive, especially in those early years, the white media cast aspersions on him. And they had absolutely nothing critical to say about some of these boneheaded preachers who called themselves criticizing Dr. King. But these black mouthpieces, particularly these black so-called preachers who were attacking Dr. King, this was a smear campaign coordinated by and carried out against Dr. King by the government. One of the biggest and loudest detractors against Dr. King was a mulatto pulpit pimp calling himself Elder Lightfoot Solomon Michaud. These pork chop preachers really love their highfalutin titles, now don't they? Now, Michaud started his little preacher man hustle in the 1920s with a radio show which, according to the New York Times, was met with national acclaim. Now, that's your first clue he's dirty. And then 20 years after that, he becomes the first minister.
See, one of the things that happened with Dr. King show, doors open up.
The Creflo Dollar of his day. Let's be clear here. The government gave this guy a platform, and neither the regulatory agencies nor the IRS nor anyone else tried to shut him down. Now, don't you think that's just a little bit strange? This guy was coming up at a time when they were lynching black people in the streets. Race riots were rampant across the country, and this guy was being allowed to have a radio show and then a TV show, and apparently the same racists who were murdering black people and committing localized genocides weren't worried about him at all, and neither was the government. Of course, there was good reason for that. Elder Michaud was an FBI agent, or as they called him, a special correspondent. Then, as now, the white supremacists in the government knew how it would look if they were the ones to attack King, especially if they were the ones who tried to come out against him first. So they needed a black stooge to be their stalking horse and to break the ice. Then they would follow behind him. So the FBI would feed Michaud talking points that King was a communist, etc., and Michaud would repeat those talking points on his show to his audience. But of course, he'd make sure to leave out the part about how the FBI handed him these things to say. But the FBI's coordination with their stooge, Michaud, went beyond that. Michaud even organized a so-called protest against Dr. King, where he had about 100, 120 or so handkerchief-headed Negroes who had called themselves protesting the communist King. And of course, you would then have the FBI show up, followed with the white media closely in tow, and they would say, why, we've got to question this King. This King guy, we've been hearing some serious stuff. We're just following up on what our boy Michaud over here has said. He's very well known and well respected in the Negro community, and his accusations are very serious, blah, blah, blah. That's what they were doing. And the reason why is Dr. King's moral authority was unassailable. Dr. King had successfully framed the civil rights struggle as being a moral struggle, and the white government has been trying to destroy King's moral legitimacy ever since. This is where we get FBI-generated lies, like the biggest one of all, that King was some sort of adulterer, that he ever cheated on his wife. Dr. King's power came from the fact that everyone recognized him to be a moral man. And since the white government could not deny or disprove his accusations, they instead invented lies out of whole cloth. And all the lies had the exact same through line. Dr. King wasn't a moral man. And it was bootlicking traitors like Michaud who helped to push those lies. This is part of the phony Dr. King that the white media invented. So whenever you see the white media or some fool on the street trying to claim that there were black people who said this or that about Dr. King, just remember Elder Michaud. Most, if not all, the attacks on Dr. King during his life and certainly after his death came from the government. And the people they try to point to as telling these lies, these were paid informants. And before you let anyone tell you that they heard one or two people in the movement who were making accusations about King, just remember, the Black Panthers were infested with FBI informants. So you truly believe that SNCC and the SCLC were not targets of massive FBI infiltration as well? Isn't it strange how so many of those people who were marching with Dr. King managed to survive and they weren't the ones who got assassinated? And a lot of them went on to have high and well-paid positions in government and in the media. Yeah, I'm talking about Andy Young and Messy Jesse. And just so you know, there's still a lot of black folks even to this day who have fond memories of Elder Michaud and still hold him in high regard all these decades later. After the powers that be assassinated Dr. King, the white media realized that rather than getting rid of a problem, they had instead created a martyr. So white supremacy, being deviously sophisticated, didn't try to attack him. That wouldn't have worked. Instead, they pretended to honor him, like every other moral person was doing, except the white media presented a false, twisted caricature of Dr. King. They took a few select sentences, or even words of his, totally out of context, rearranged them, and then applied them for the sake of pushing a lie that Dr. King only wanted to live peacefully beside white people, and he certainly didn't have any economic demands, when the truth was that economics was the primary demand that he had. They ignored fully 95% of what Dr. King said so that they could instead manufacture this straw man who would be completely and thoroughly inoffensive and unthreatening toward the dominant society.
I think the other thing that we must see at this time is that many of the people who supported us in Selma, in Birmingham, were really outraged about the extremist behavior toward Negroes. But they were not at that moment, and they are not now, committed to genuine equality for Negroes. It's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee an annual income, for instance, to get rid of poverty for Negroes and all poor people. It's much easier to integrate a bus than it is to make genuine integration a reality and quality education a reality in our schools. It's much easier to integrate even a public park than it is to get rid of slums. And I think we are in a new era, a new phase of the struggle, where we have moved from a struggle for decency, which characterized our struggle for 10 or 12 years, to a struggle for genuine equality. And this is where we're getting the resistance, because there was never any intention to go this far. People were reacting to Bull Connor and to Jim Clark rather than acting in good faith for the realization of genuine equality. I think the vast majority of white Americans will go but so far. It's a kind of installment plan for equality. And they are always looking for an excuse to go but so far.
For 50 years, we've seen a white media operation to manufacture a false version of Dr. King, one that doesn't threaten white dominance. The white supremacists, particularly in the white media, they understand that a Dr. King who only wants for black and white children to play nicely together on the playground is also a Dr. King who doesn't want black children to compete on the world stage. A Dr. King who only cares about peace and quiet above all other things is also a Dr. King who doesn't make demands, doesn't make noise for his people's empowerment, and doesn't make white people uncomfortable. A Dr. King who only gives eloquent-sounding speeches talking about peace all the time is also a Dr. King who will never tell people that they have to fight to put an end to white supremacy. A Dr. King who either agrees with not threatening white power, or at the very least is silent on the issue, is a Dr. King that's not going to rock the boat. And they tell us that we should follow that example, even though that's not what Dr. King stood for at all. They want you to either follow their perverted false caricature of Dr. King, or they want you to reject him as being an impotent appeaser to white supremacy. But what they don't want for you to do is to actually look at the man for yourself, because if you do, you'll see that he was nothing like what the white media tells you he was. The Dr. King that the white media invented was not the true Dr. King at all. It was rather a warped negative image of him. One that on the surface might use one or two of his words, but beyond that had nothing in common with the man himself at all. And it was all meant to program us by presenting him as a role model for what black people ought to be, an inoffensive spokesman talking in vague, indistinct terms about our racial equality, but never being told exactly what must be done to achieve it other than just liking people. And to accept abuse because it's the Christian thing to do. It's the morally superior thing to do. And if you let these white supremacists beat you up long enough, they'll feel sorry for you or otherwise become inclined to change their ways. Now, it's fully understandable how people could have gotten this misimpression of Dr. King. The white media took his I Have a Dream speech and they made that the totality of the man. The King that most people know is one invented by the white media and pushed on us by white corporations who give us empty rhetoric about living the dream. Adult black people, particularly baby boomers, would see this constant stream of white media distortions of Dr. King, and they would be brainwashed with false memories of what he was. And younger generations, like Generation X, would be indoctrinated with a weak, feeble version of Dr. King that never truly existed. Another of the big lies that the white media pushed about Dr. King was that he was completely and thoroughly opposed to any and all violence, certainly on the behalf of black
people. Morally, I was led to nonviolence because I felt that it was the best moral way to deal with the problem. We were seeking to establish a just society. And it was my feeling then, and it is my feeling now, that violence is certainly much more socially destructive, and it creates many more social problems than it solves. So I was led to nonviolence for deep moral reasons. Now, there is no doubt about the fact that in our struggle in Montgomery and all over the United States for that matter, nonviolence is also practically sound. It would just be impractical for the Negro to turn to violence. He has neither the instruments nor the techniques of violence. We are about 10 or 11% of the total population of the nation, and I would say we are about 0.1% of the firepower. So it would just be totally impractical and unwise and unrealistic for the Negro to think of violence. Well, I saw this in the beginning in Montgomery, but this wasn't the basic reason that I turned to nonviolence and that I believed in it as a philosophy. I turned to it because I felt that it was the morally excellent way to deal with the problem of racial injustice in our country.
Now, did you hear what he actually said? He never said that nonviolence is never justified or isn't even preferable. He said that black people didn't have the numbers or the firepower to pull it off. And that from a personal standpoint, he saw nonviolence as a morally excellent way to achieve change. But at no point did he say violence, especially in self-defense, is never justified and there's no excuse for it. And he won't stand for it and he's outright opposed to it. The white media lies when it claims that Dr. King was opposed to violence. What he was doing was attempting to bring about change with as little damage and destruction as possible. What he was expressing in advocating for nonviolence, philosophical preference for him personally and a tactical preference for black people as a group. But at no point did Dr. King say that violence was never called for or never justified. And what about when violence did occur? While it's true that Dr. King asked that everyone who marched with him be peaceful, when the social frustration with white supremacy exploded into the predictable uprisings, Dr. King never pulled an Obama. He never condemned the uprisings. He didn't call the people in the streets thugs. Instead, he explained to the nation why it was happening. Riots are the language of the unheard. Dr. King merely told the nation the exact same thing Kennedy did when he said, those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable. That's not someone opposed to violence as much as someone trying to prevent violence from becoming completely unavoidable. That's why when the streets exploded, Dr. King spoke for the freedom fighters and not the establishment. He didn't do like the sniveling and corrupt black bootlick misleaders we've got today and whine about property damage. Dr. King understood that if this nation refuses to respect black people's human rights, then don't complain when someone refuses to respect your property rights.
When machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A civilization can flounder as readily in the face of moral bankruptcy as it can through financial bankruptcy.
The people fighting in the streets had an advocate in Dr. King, not an opponent. He was a black man who told this white supremacist nation some unpleasant truths about themselves that they didn't want to hear, and that the white media wants to make sure that you don't hear. The white media made sure that you heard a few select snippets from the I Have a Dream speech, but they almost never play anything from Dr. King's The Three Evils of Society speech. That was a speech that he gave well after the March on Washington, when he was starting to say what he thought about the dream and what it had become in the years since. I want you to listen to what Dr. King had to say regarding the presidential race between Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater. And if you take out the names Lyndon Johnson and Barry Goldwater and insert the names Joe Biden and Donald Trump, you tell me if this political assessment by Dr. King sounds like it was written in 1967 or 2022.
Many assemble here campaigned assiduously for Lyndon Johnson in 1964 because we could not stand idle by and watch our nation contaminated by the 18th century policies of Goldwaterism. We were the hardcore activists who were willing to believe that Southerners could be reconstructed in the Constitution image. We were dreamers of a dream. That dark yesterdays of man's inhumanity to man would soon be transformed into bright tomorrows of justice. Now it is hard to escape the disillusionment of betrayal. Our hopes have been blasted and our dreams have been shattered.
The dream has been shattered. Yeah, you see, Dr. King already gave his assessment on whether or not his dream was going to become a reality. He already gave his assessment on that. And he said the dream had been shattered. But the white media's not going to tell you that when they're going to tell you to keep on dreaming. So you see, it doesn't matter if it's 1967 or 2016. The exact same rationales that were used that had black people understandably scared that Barry Goldwater would drag the country back into the 18th century with the exact same talking points that were used in regards to Donald Trump. But it's even worse in the case of Trump versus Biden because at least Johnson had actually put some laws on the books, though he didn't actually put teeth behind the laws. Joe Biden had put laws on the books too, but he put laws on the books to punish black people and then turned around 30 plus years later saying, now vote for me. Black people felt they had to go to the polls to support Lyndon Johnson. Didn't know what he was going to, weren't sure what he had actually done for them, but they had to go or else. Well, Dr. King and others made sure that Johnson won his presidential bid in 64, and what happened? What happened, as Dr. King put it, was a betrayal. The exact same thing that happened when Joe Biden became president. The times may change, but the lies remain exactly the same. Now, another interesting point about Dr. King's Three Evils of Society speech is that he pointed out that you had young people, especially in the North, he had been starting to get booed by these young black people that he had in the organization, and he couldn't understand why, at least not at first.
And all the speaking that I have done in the United States before varied audiences, including some hostile whites, the only time that I have ever been booed was one night in our regular weekly mass meeting by some angry young men of our movement. Selfishly, I thought of my sufferings and sacrifices over the last 12 years. Why would they boo one so close to them? But as I lay awake thinking, I finally came to myself. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful.
Now there's realization on Dr. King's part. After so many years of protesting and activism, he was not the only one who realized that these younger cats in the streets, they were looking and deciding that maybe he was wrong and they were starting to tune him out. He wasn't the only one who thought about that. In fact, James Baldwin voiced the exact same concern a few years earlier.
What is dangerous here is the turning away from anything any white American says. The reason for the political hesitation in spite of the Johnson landslide is that one has been betrayed by American politicians for so long. And I'm a grown man, and perhaps I can be reasoned with. I certainly hope I can be. But I don't know. And neither does Martin Luther King. None of us know how to deal with those other people whom the white world has so long ignored, who don't believe anything the white world says, and don't entirely believe anything I or Martin say. And one can't blame them. You watch what has happened to them in less than 20 years.
Dr. King had been demanding laws that were going to bring justice, economic justice, to black people. And what did the government do instead? What they decided was they needed laws to punish black people.
And so the collision course is set. The people cry for freedom, and the Congress attempts to legislate repression. Unemployment rages at a major depression level in the black ghettos. But the bipartisan response is an anti-riot bill rather than a serious poverty program. The modest proposals for a moderate city's rent supplement and rat control, pitiful as they were to begin with, get caught in the maze of congressional inaction. And I submit to you tonight that a Congress that proves to be more anti-Negro than anti-rat needs to be dismissed.
Many of the senators from the North and the West, and congressmen generally who voted for civil rights legislation in 64 and even 65 of the Voting Rights Bill, refused last year to vote for civil rights legislation because it dealt with an issue applicable to the North, the whole housing question. And this, it seems to me, was the greatest expression of the hypocrisy of many of our citizens and many of the senators and congressmen of the North.
Oh, how different this is from Obama. Barack Obama didn't pass any executive orders telling the Justice Department or the Department of Defense to punish police and sheriff's departments, to withhold any sort of aid from these terrorist organizations if they harm black people. He did nothing to punish the police or to protect black people. However, he did write his asinine Blue Alert executive order that was meant to embolden the thugs in blue and hopefully maintain the support of the barbaric police unions for Hillary's presidential campaign. I think we all know how that one turned out.
I wish that I could say that this is just a passing phase in the cycle of our nation's life, but I suspect that we are now experiencing the coming to the surface of a triple-pronged sickness. That is the sickness of racism, excessive materialism, and militarism.
At last, Dr. King formally lists the three evils. Now, racism we understand well enough, and militarism, that's pretty obvious too, abroad and within the United States, so no need to cover old ground on that one. But we do need to take a good long look at materialism. The white media pushes upon black people this false identity that we're supposed to be the ultimate consumers, as if this is a good thing. We oversample on way too many things. We buy everything but own nothing. We patronize everyone else's stores, but we control nothing. We take pride in how much we buy, but we don't give a thought to what the heck we actually own. We obsess over Gucci bags and luxury cars, but we don't own a fashion store and can't stop white race soldiers from pulling us over and killing us right next to our luxury car. We're focused on the wrong things. buying ghetto trinkets in our pathetic quest to impress the other slaves on the plantation. Changing your appearance does not change your condition. Buying a fancy house means very little when a gang of white supremacist thugs can kick in the front door and drag you out in handcuffs like they did Skip Gates, or when they can murder you outright in your own home like they did a Tatiana Jefferson and Botham Jean. Focusing on getting yourself designer clothes means nothing when these white supremacists can replace your tailor-made Armani suit with a state-issued prison uniform.
Ever since the birth of our nation, white America has had a schizophrenic personality on the question of race. She has been torn between selves, a self in which she proudly professed the great principles of democracy, and a self in which she madly practiced the antithesis of democracy. This tragic duality has produced a strange indecisiveness and ambivalence toward the Negro, causing America to take a step backwards simultaneously with every step forward on the question of racial justice. There has never been a solid, unified, and determined thrust to make justice a reality for Afro-Americans. The step backward has a new name today. It is called the white backlash. But the white backlash is nothing new. It is a surfacing of old prejudices, hostilities, and ambivalences that have always been there. It was caused neither by the cry of black power, nor by the unfortunate recent wave of riots in our cities. The white backlash of today is rooted in the same problem that has characterized America ever since the black man landed in chains on the shores of this nation.
Nope, I don't think McDonald's or Burger King or GM are going to be doing any commercials with a sound clip from that speech. See, this is the Dr. King that the white media doesn't play for you. Dr. King was a minister, and like any good preacher, he understood that a big part of his job was to convict the heathens of their sins. The white media wanted to invent a Dr. King who would never do that, a Dr. King who only thought about sunshine and rainbows, and would never say that white society had been dishonest. But that's what the real Dr. King said. He didn't mince words. He didn't use euphemisms or substitute labels. He said white America specifically. This was a critique aimed at the citizenry. The white media tries to frame Dr. King's moral exhortations as if he only spoke about the government or about this or that group of white supremacists. He never meant what he said towards the white society in general, but listening to his words, we see that he did. Now here, Dr. King used the word schizophrenic in lieu of a term that would be more direct. The problem, though, wasn't indecision. It's that this society wants to continue being anti-black racist, but not have to carry the stigma and the label of bigot that goes along with it. So it pretends to be trying when in truth it's just a trick, a ruse meant to con us into waiting to see when they'll make up their minds, when in reality they've had their minds made up from the very beginning.
However, for the good of America, it is necessary to refute the idea that the dominant ideology in our country, even today, is freedom and equality, while racism is just an occasional departure from the norm on the part of a few bigoted extremists. Racism can well be that corrosive evil that will bring down the curtain on Western civilization. Arnold Toynbee has said that some 26 civilizations have risen upon the face of the earth. Almost all of them have descended into the junk heaps of destruction. The decline and fall of these civilizations, according to Toynbee, was not caused by external invasions, but by internal decay. If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
I think the first thing that needs to be said is that, as John Henry Clark observed, the United States cannot be called a civilization because the root word of civilization is civil, which this country has never been. But to continue, Dr. King pointed out that racism would bring down American society. What needs to be understood, however, is that you can't save someone who doesn't want to be saved. And what's true for the individual is also true for the group. You can't save a society that doesn't want to be saved. Anti-black racism is the opiate of the masses. This nation is addicted to harming black people. It is addicted to anti-black racism. It has been since before the founding of the nation. And their behavior is no different than all these meth addicts that you see overdosing all across the country. In fact, the opioid epidemic is the perfect metaphor for this country and racism. America gets a euphoric high from anti-black violence. Attacking us, denigrating us, harming us, depriving us of our rights. It's a sick pleasure for this sick country that it loves, and it will do anything to keep indulging itself. Now their addiction is killing them. Not only has it become so bad that they're consciously refusing to take care of their own day-to-day affairs necessary to sustain themselves, but their neighbors are looking at them as a problem, and some of the local bad actors now see them as easy prey. When you're strung out all the time, your friends and family begin to give up on you, and thieves and pickpockets see you as ripe for the taking. Today, you have a chemical called Narcan. Narcan is used as a means to instantly neutralize the opioid content in the addict's veins and keep them from dying. The racial political equivalent of Narcan would be racial justice policies. Punish those who practice anti-black racism and stop impeding black economic, social, and political progress. Whenever this nation has instituted these types of reforms, it has given itself a new lease on life. It has restored its image in the eyes of the world and prevented itself from collapsing. The only problem is that, as with opioids, it wasn't long before the addicts figured out that if they got their hands on some Narcan, they could overdose on purpose, literally commit suicide, and so long as someone was standing by with the Narcan at the ready, they could gratify themselves with a high so deep that it nearly kills them, but not have to die from it. This is what we see from America today, what we've seen for the last 50 years, hell, the last 150 years. Ever since the end of chattel slavery, this country has presented a false image to the world and to itself that it was dealing with its addiction to anti-black racism, all the while putting policies in place to intensify that very same racism. It could manufacture good optics for itself by having a Colin Powell as head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or letting Eddie Murphy become the biggest movie star on the planet, and then pass the 1986 Anti-Drug Abuse Act, which created the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity between rock cocaine and powder cocaine, and then in 1994 passed the 94 Crime Bill, which turbocharged the prison industrial complex. The government funnels military-grade equipment to police departments and lets them kill black people with impunity and helps gentrify black neighborhoods out of existence. It indulges allowing the undeservedly richest people in the country to confiscate the nation's wealth. And just when the country was on the verge of a revolution in 2008, they pretend to deal with the nation's cardinal sin by putting a mulatto in the White House. People forgot all about that kill Wall Street stuff and instead bask in the empty glow of thinking that they'd never have to hear about racism from black people ever again. That's why you had so many of those suburbanites who were celebrating Obama's victory. Just like the opioid addict, this country, addicted to anti-black racism, figured they could have it both ways, pumping themselves up with all manner of physical and economic violence against us, and then, when they're only a hair's breadth from dying, give themselves a life-saving injection of justice. We need to accept the fact that the dominant society would sooner commit suicide than save themselves. The problem isn't that they're deceived or confused or in the grip of something bigger than themselves. The problem is exactly the opposite. They're in complete control. This constant one step forward, one step back isn't indecision on their parts. It's them indulging themselves. They're not moving, and they like it this way.
Again, we have deluded ourselves into believing the myth that capitalism grew and prospered out of the Protestant ethic of hard work and sacrifice. The fact is that capitalism was built on the exploitation and suffering of black slaves. We must further recognize that the ghetto is a domestic colony. the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. This has driven many to feel that only Marxism has the revolutionary spirit. In a sense, communism is a judgment of our failure to make democracy real and to follow through on the revolutions that we initiated.
Yeah, you had Dr. King telling everybody that capitalism was based on slavery and that, yeah, people were turning to Marxism because they were looking for something that had the revolutionary spirit. They were looking for an alternative to capitalism, or at least an alternative to the white supremacist control of it. This is the Dr. King that's problematic. It's problematic for the white left because, truth be told, they don't want to have to actually admit that the country's wealth is based on white supremacy and anti-black racism, because at some point you got to say, okay, what's going to be done about it if you guys claim to be the moral left? And the right wing, which has tried this asinine campaign of trying to claim that Dr. King would have been against affirmative action when he was one of the biggest proponents of it and all the rest of it, these guys, they definitely don't want to bring this up. Dr. King saying capitalism is a problem and saying it was based out of slavery. And yeah, people are turning to Marxism and it's common sense that they would. Yeah, this is problematic for the white left and the white right. So that being the case, Dr. King needs to be completely and thoroughly politically castrated. He's just basically somebody who speaks about loving your neighbor and all that stuff. He's talking about this mamby-pamby innocuous fluff. But what did Dr. King think about capitalism? He really didn't say. He was more interested in the moral dimension, you see. The moral, looking beyond skin color, that's what he was about. Becoming a colorblind society, that was Dr. King's primary preoccupation.
We are called to play the Good Samaritans on life's roadside, but that will only be an initial act. One day the whole Jericho road must be transformed so that men and women will not be beaten and robbed as they make that journey through life. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It understands that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring.
Dr. King lays out a complete and thorough remaking of a society, not just tinkering around the edges. He's talking about remaking the whole thing. A fundamental balance of power, that's what he's talking about. All this stuff is economic. You notice how much of what he says is economic. We're way past the whole thing about let's be nice to each other. If we could just hold hands without these white supremacists deciding to attack black folks. In this case, now we're getting to the money. How the wealth has been confiscated and taken from black people. And how the wealth is now going to have to be put back into the hands of those who generated it in the first place. This is the Dr. King that they don't want to talk about, because once you start talking about this Dr. King, then it becomes, oh, so the dream was an economic dream. And yeah, the dream was indeed betrayed. Because in order to have a deal, you got to have two honest brokers. And one of the brokers wasn't honest at all. Now, I'm going to voice something that the white media would call radical, but which is only common sense. We don't have to worry about lifting the whole world out of poverty or solving the issues of the entire planet. This world is in the grip of a demonic system of racial oppression. The foundation of that system is anti-black racism. The uprisings of 2020 led to a global movement for change that all the empty marching and chanting of white people in the lead up to the Iraq war failed to achieve. I submit the radical common sense idea that we only need to concern ourselves with changing the condition of black people, specifically in this country, because the United States is the leader of the world. Change the condition of black people here, and you will by default change the world. Improve the economic condition of black people here, and you will have improved the economic condition of the entire world. Trying to do it any other way is a complete waste of time. That's the lesson of the last 100 years or so. White supremacists love to get their opponents to waste their time, running in circles, doing piecemeal efforts in Nepal or the Amazon. That's meaningless. The entire world has fallen under the satanic sway of an evil system, a system that rests comfortably on the backs of black people in the U.S. So long as we remain underneath this evil, the best that the world can hope for are minor cosmetic changes. a black celebrity here or the occasional black president there, but these are distinctions without a difference because it doesn't change the balance of power, and the balance of power is based on resources. We don't need different optics. We need a different status quo. If you destabilize the foundation of this evil system of racial hierarchy, then the entire system will fall because there will be nothing to hold it up. The problem is that too many people, including a lot of non-white ones, have been eating very well off of this system of anti-black racism. Anti-black racism has given them a comfortable lifestyle, so they're invested in perpetuating it. They see their interests as being aligned with the white powers that be. So when you talk about toppling white supremacy, these sock puppets for white supremacy will feel threatened because they understand that they depend on MASA for every crumb of their daily bread. MASA feeds them now. Sure, he doesn't feed them as well as he does those classified as white, but at least he throws them the occasional crumb, and for them, that's enough. Pets don't ask for much. That's not justice. That's cronyism and nepotism. They know that if black people bring down this system and institute a system of justice, then we're not going to feed them. They will have to actually earn their daily bread. Take a look at the bootlicks who have tried to reinvent themselves without the largesse they receive from the dominant society. They've shriveled up and blown away. So make no mistake, white supremacists understand that they have to cultivate and sustain a multitude of agents and operatives if white supremacy is going to last. The bootlicks will give them rhetorical cover by claiming white supremacy either doesn't exist, this is what the black conservative claims, or if it does, it's not as bad as that, this is what the black liberal claims. Both the black liberal and the black conservative agree on the lie that things are better now than they were before. So no matter which bootlicks you choose to believe, the one on Massa's left hand or the one on his right, it's still the same puppet show spouting the same lies. And some of the biggest lies they've told have been about black people's icons, trying to derange and distort and pervert our symbols, because symbols are a unifying principle. You can have people following the teachings and following the philosophy of Dr. King decades after the man's assassination. The man's not here anymore, but you got people who are still trying to follow it. But the problem is they're attempting to follow a false counterfeit distortion of Dr. King, one that's the exact opposite of the real man, one presented to them by their oppressors. Now, the things that we say here doesn't tickle people's ears and it doesn't please everyone, but it's not meant to. The demands of power are not meant to make you smile. They're meant to make you strong. Controlling your own destiny is not necessarily meant to give you pleasure. What it's supposed to give you is power. A lot of people have disagreed mightily with the things that we've said over the last 15 years, especially when it came time to talk about the 2016 and 2020 elections. People didn't want to believe that Donald Trump could win, but we told them that he could and that he would. People didn't want to believe in 2020 that once Joe Biden won the election that he was going to immediately turn his back on black people, and you would be surprised how much the Biden administration would closely resemble the Trump administration. People didn't want to believe that. They wanted to believe that you could actually get something without making a demand, that you could trust a man whose entire life has been spent spitting in black people's faces. People didn't want to hear that, so a large number of them ignored it. Well, who has history borne out? You cannot be childish and capricious and think that you will also have power. You cannot decide that you're going to plug your ears to anything that you don't like hearing and think that you're going to be in control. It doesn't work that way. Nor can we decide that we're going to water down the message or dilute it or try to amalgamate it so that it appeals to every Tom, Dick, and Harry, Jane, Sue, and Mary. That's not what black empowerment's about. Too many times, black people have found themselves confronted with the choice of what do you do to make sure that you take a step closer to power. And when that decision involves being unpopular or saying something that doesn't tickle people's ears, black people tend to shy away. Well, that's not what we're about. The New Voices of Black Media, we know better, so we're doing better. We're not like the Elder Michauds or the Roly-Poly Martins or the Joy Reeds or the rest of the fakers, frauds, phonies, fools, sellouts, suck-ups, and simps. For 500 years, the world has become completely and thoroughly accustomed to a status quo where black people are the underclass, and that's that, and not only are black people not able to change it necessarily, but in many cases, black people just don't even say that that's the situation they're in. To a large degree, we have allowed the society to pretend as if it's made progress when it really hasn't. But then again, that's not entirely our fault. The Dominant Society has sent in whole armies of rhetoricians and a whole bunch of paid agents to tell us that we're making great strides when the truth of the matter was they were barely baby steps, if that. The white media with their black bootlicks have preached a nonstop gospel of, well, as black people, we need to make sure that we don't ruffle any feathers, and we need to make sure that nobody disapproves of us, because if they do, well, we're disrupting the racial harmony, so you need to suffer in silence so that nobody looks at you and says, hey, you're making us noise about things, you're making us stink, you got to stop it. This is the societal role that the white media has tried to program us with, and which a whole bunch of the people in the society, particularly the political class, have beaten us over the head with relentlessly and told us this is our place and this is what we're supposed to do because it's what Dr. King would do. Well, we're not going to listen to any lies. We're going to tell the truth as he would want us to, and we're going to tell the truth the way that he did, no matter who doesn't like it.
Howard has asked the question, is it faith? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? On some positions, it is necessary for the moral individual to take a stand that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must do it because it is right.
Mm-hmm.